This episode of the Research VR podcast is brought to you by Haptics. Haptics gloves are an industrial-grade tool designed for professional VR applications. Leading automakers in Asia, Europe, and North America are using Haptics gloves to design their new vehicles. By using VR and Haptics, they're reducing their need for physical prototypes, saving them significant time and money. If you work for a business that would benefit from Haptics gloves, get in touch with Haptics by emailing them at partners@haptics.com. That's partners@haptics.com. And be sure to mention the Research VR podcast. We're excited to have Haptics as our first ever sponsor on this show because we know the need for haptic feedback in VR. I mean, that's like such a huge problem that we've talked about for years. And Haptics really has been one of the best implementations of a solution for haptic feedback in VR. They're looking for businesses and developers with ideas. So if you have some, feel free to contact them and let them know that you're there because of this show. Also, I should mention we did an episode with their founder not too long ago. If you go back a few episodes, you'll hear it. So, on to the show. Hello and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, everyone. The podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. I'm your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is David Deco, the CEO and co-founder of Skylights, which is a way of bringing VR onto planes for passenger entertainment. Hello, David.
Hi there. Pleasure to be speaking.
Good to have you here. And of course, beaming in from Germany, we have Mr. Peter Leckhoff.
Hello, everyone. And if my voice crackles this time a little bit, I just came from VR Days. It was awesome. Everyone who I met there, big greetings to you. And yeah, I will try to not too much rumble today with my voice, but let's see. Looking forward.
So a way we like to start these conversations off, David, is I like to ask, how did you find yourself within this realm of virtual reality? Perhaps like how, what were your motivations? What were your interests? And perhaps if you have any sort of relevant experience in your career beforehand, feel free to talk about it.
Sure. Well, let me give you just a one-minute rundown of my background, and then that thing that will drive in nicely into how I got into this position. But I was an airline pilot for 15 years. I flew Airbus A320s, and I flew Boeing 777s, and then I went into airline management. But it was the airlines was my world, the entirety of my world, business-wise, operations-wise, and, of course, then as a pilot. And when I undertook, when I took my management positions in the airline, I went ahead and did management training, did an MBA, and there I met a host of other people working for a bunch of other industries, including an entrepreneur who was a VR entrepreneur. And he wanted to launch a essentially YouTube for VR 360 videos at the time. And we were back, this was back in 2013. We were pre Samsung Gear VR. We were, I think, right before the Cardboard, or it was right about that time. And, actually, it was before the Cardboard. And we met, and he was interested in my industry because, obviously, being in VR and then, you know, nascency of at least the rebirth of the VR wave, he was, you know, looking at use cases that made sense. And obviously he thought, well, there's all these short haul flights where there's absolutely no in-flight entertainment. I should speak to David. Maybe this is something that's interesting. And so we met, had a coffee, had a chat. And on that chat, pretty much I gave him advice that we are essentially following now a few years later. And among those pieces of advice was, well, don't go into the short haul or medium haul flights. I would focus more on the long haul flights. So yeah, so that was really the beginning of it. And he, my first VR experience per se, is that he was a hardware hacker. So he, you know, had a hardware engineering background, and in VR he had designed at the time a sort of Samsung Gear VR before the Samsung Gear VR. He showed me, or he made me discover my first VR experience just to show me what he was talking about. And it became very, very clear to me from the get-go and from that very first experience that this was going to change, very obviously, the entire entertainment industry, of which a tiny component is in-flight entertainment. So it, you know, I remember telling him very distinctly, here, you're onto something. This is very cool, obviously, but beyond that, this is a fantastic opportunity to jump into. Good luck. And that was it. That was the beginning. Yeah.
That's fascinating. So, I think where we can start to talk about Skylights is the fact that you guys are actually building your own headset, and this is unlike other headsets that exist in the world. Or I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misinterpreting the product. So maybe actually let's start with you introducing Skylights and kind of this end-to-end solution that you've built for everything from the hardware to the software to the servicing.
Sure.
Because I don't know how many people in the VR industry have even considered that there could be a service for VR planes, apart from people just bringing, you know, a handful of people bringing in their own Gear VRs or Oculus Go's.
Well, I think everyone working in the VR space has thought of VR on planes as passenger and flight entertainment. There's, congrats to Flo, my co-founder, for having thought of that. But at the same time, I think anybody who deals with VR has thought of that one way, shape, or form, or another. In part because it is one of the so obvious places where a lot of us want to kind of escape, and people are captive and they're stuck there for a long time. So the idea is not extraordinary. The key point about this was how we would go about trying to make this into an actual viable business. And Skylights has been, from its inception, very focused on that use case. Not focused initially on the technology, but making sure that we had what was required that in order to properly propel this use case forward. And I think that difference in approach is a difference that this is a difference in approach that I've noticed with another host of VR companies who've been specifically tech-focused or focused around a specific part of the technology. And then saying, well, you know, I'll develop this thing and then everybody will use it. We took it the reverse way and says, okay, well, we know that there's an obvious use case and there's an obvious benefit for passengers, but what do we need to have to make this actually happen? And and taking it that way, we underwent to do something that actually, if I had known it would be so difficult at the beginning, I'm not sure we would have done that. But so it is. You know, at first it felt relatively simple. It felt as if we needed to find some sort of headset on the market that made sense, develop some very basic UI entertainment software, and voila, sell that to airlines. We could wait, of course, for passengers to bring in their own VR headsets, but that we knew if we were waiting for that, we'd probably still be waiting
right
for another 5 years. So at least, at the very least, I can explain why. But so we wanted to go through the airlines. And at first it seemed very simple. And actually what we discovered is that we couldn't find a headset on the market that satisfied our passengers enough that it made sense over and beyond what they have in the seat back screens that are embedded on the seats. That was number one. And we had problems of comfort. We had problems of resolution. No aha moments for anybody working in VR. These were things that plague and continue to plague VR headsets today. So we suffered these two things. But one key factor is that after intense testing, we just couldn't get it off the ground with the market headsets, and we were trying essentially Gear VRs or Gear VR equivalents. And you know, now we still continue to test to A/B test with other headsets and like the Oculus Go, but we're still struggling with the headset piece. And so, yeah, go ahead.
And just one question in between. So around that time that you were building that company, as far as I understand, the Cinemizer OLED multimedia video glasses were also on the market, and also more let's say less VR and more cinematographic devices on the market. So what was the problem with them, and why were you really looking forward towards the more immersive headsets like the Gear VR and not so much to the really video focused ones?
Did you own a Zeiss Cinemizer?
No, not myself.
Okay, so we did. Go on the forums and you'll see why. The main reason, the Zeiss Cinemizer had two plaguing problems. and I hope that Zeiss won't mind me for saying this, but one of them was comfort. It was an extraordinarily uncomfortable headset, despite being light. And that is due to how they designed the place, the headset contact with the nose. So they had different nose pieces, a little bit like the HoloLens today. But those pieces were just kill your experience. Within 15 minutes, you'd want to take the headset off. And that actually shows you the sensitivity of design, hardware design on detail that can derail, the efforts of everyone else working on this headset, including the optics and so on and so forth. And Zeiss had fantastic optics, but it had a second problem. It was they were using at the time, and this was quite revolutionary of them, they were using, I believe, for the Zeiss Zenimizer 1 or 2, micro OLED screens. I don't know who was manufacturing these screens. But anyway, they were using those micro OLED screens, and they had decided to, I suppose, for a first or second release, to play it safe and have relatively, well, had optical systems whose, blow up ratio was relatively modest. And so the field of view you would get when you wore these headsets was around 30, it was in the high 30s in terms of degrees. It was below 40 degrees, something like 38 degrees. And the problem with 38 degrees is that that's the 35 or something like that, is that that is the field of view that you would get more or less plus or minus a few degrees that you would get with watching content on your iPad or on your computer or on your seatback screen. And so suddenly the added value, beyond the fact that it's uncomfortable after 15 minutes, but even if they had solved that problem, there was no added value for the passenger in using that device over a seatback screen. And so that was an issue. If we were going to try and convince an industry that is notorious for being slow in introducing changes, for good reason, but the airline industry is not a fantastic place for innovation. We had to do it with something that was compelling in terms of the passenger use case. And it was we tried the Zeiss, removed that. We tried the Sony, that didn't work either. We tried the Gear VR, that didn't work either. So yeah.
So clarification point is the use case you're looking for to fulfill with VR and headsets, or sorry, in VR and planes, is not the active form of entertainment with like controllers and playing games, but it's much more of the passive form of entertainment, right?
Well, that's another piece of this. So the use case is, let me precise the use case. The use case is in-flight entertainment using head-mounted devices, using headsets. But the question is, once you say that, you have to figure out which headset you're going to bring on, but you also have to figure out supposing that there were 50 Skylights companies trying their best at this, what is the passenger offering that would take over? Is it a showing an experience with the VR games that people will enjoy? Is it putting them on the VR roller coaster, which was one of the earliest contents that we had in VR? Right. Is it showing them 360 content? Is it showing them regular movies? What is it? And we experimented. We tried everything. We measured what people did. We showed them everything. Here's a headset. It has everything. Now go ahead. You use it, and I'll see what you do. And the fact of the matter is that up to today, the use of this is passenger use. If you give them everything that they can do. So let me say precise: games, movies, 3D or 2D, 360 videos. So these are like the four. Let's call those the four categories. Up to today, we have these four offerings that we give passengers. They spend about 90% of their time in movies, and it splits half and half between 3D and 2D, and that's mostly due to the fact that stereoscopic 3D movies tend to be blockbuster movies and so on and so forth, but those who go for indie titles and so on and so forth don't have access to 3D. So 90% of that time is spent on movies. And then 10% is spent on what you would more call more regular VR. And again, 90% of their time spent on within that 10% on VR 360 passive, and 10% in active gaming. But it's normal,
right?
we're speaking about what your average passenger who's 40-45 year old with a 15-year someplace. These are people who discover HMDs for the first time, 90% of them, and they tend to revert back to what they know.
It's totally normal. And even for seasoned veterans like me, and I like to spend a lot of time in VR both for work and play, when I'm sitting in a plane, all I want is something to just completely distract me and let the hours pass by. Yeah. That's why I have Netflix, and download it. And yeah, I don't want to play. I don't want to email. I don't want to do work. Like, I rarely find myself doing work on a plane because it's just like such a bad place for me to be to do work.
Mm. Yeah. So let me just for a short moment return to this magical year 2015, 2016. I think pretty much figured out that the Zeiss and all the other devices on the market were not good enough, which I can believe. Now the question is, why did you build, or how did you decide to build your own headset in a, let's say, in a time where a lot of predictions kind of were over the roof, and a lot of analysts would say, everyone will have a VR headset in 2 years, and you kind of still, instead of relying on them, rightly figured out that they might be a little bit off, and instead of relying with people actually bringing their own hardware with them, build basically something that offers them the best experience in their case? And maybe also a second question in between, what's about audio? Because as much as an immersive experience is better than a screen in front of me, I think particularly the developments through noise cancellation, audio headphones and stuff made like flying way more immersive. And I think also, or way more, not immersive, but you can immerse yourself way more in the movies that you're watching because you can actually ignore the noise around with noise cancellation and stuff. But also people listen to podcasts and audio shows and audiobooks on flights, right? Do you cover them too?
So, two questions. Back in 2015, 2016, there were all these reports predicting, the explosion of VR. That's true. Back to who we were, we tried different headsets. It didn't work. So we had two options: close shop and wait, which in a space that seemed to be moving fast at the time, as we were kind of really gearing up in the hype of VR, seemed like not necessarily the brightest move to make, to just wait. But it was one possibility. And the other option was, why can't we use the Samsung Gear VR? We can't use the Samsung Gear VR because of resolution and perception of resolution, screen door effects. Everything seems fuzzy to our passengers, which it was. Second reason is comfort. We were getting stuck below. So let me give you the bar to begin with. When we started the Gear VR, we couldn't pass 1 hour of average usage time per passenger. This is your average passenger. You give them a Samsung Gear VR, and on average, they wouldn't be watching more than an hour, or that would be less than an hour, which seems great when you compare it to, say, a half hour usage on the ground that at least VR people are accustomed to. But the bar for us was the 4 hours that they use seatback screens, 3 hours a little bit, to be more precise. So below an hour, we couldn't convince an airline, for sure. In fact, even 2 hours not enough. We need to go to 3, 4, 5. That's where we need to be. So and my co-founder was a hardware hacker. And as I told you when we met, he had a Samsung Gear VR prototype that he had built in his garage, not quite in his garage, in his living room, but he had done it. And essentially he told me, this is not too complicated. I'm sure we can build something where if you take the Gear VR, if you take the electronics on the screen of a phone and that's there, and you just build plastic over it, and there must be a way to do this lighter than anything else that exists. And we can probably design the optics where we can choose what we want to do in terms of field of view, but there's possibly a way that we can do things crisper, or sharper in terms of image for the passengers. And so I said, try it. And what happened is, he produced an early prototype of what was at the time of an all-in-one VR headset. And this was, we were back in, this was in 2015. And trials started to take off. We were recording two and a half hours of average usage time. The way that we did this, by the way, how did we do this? We recruited beta testers. So we just basically asked people to sign up to our mailing list and raise your hand if you're going to fly. And if you fly, let us know, and we'll hand you Gear VR, or we'll hand you whatever it is, whatever headset. You watch it and tell us about the experience. And that's how we would get our feedback. And this time we're starting to get someplace. And our second employee was kind of our first employee was Kevin, and he was more hardware focused engineer as well. And they took it off from there, saying, well, you know, let's produce 100 of these, let's produce 150 of these, and this was the right strategy. There is another company that is in our space, also trying to do something similar, and they decided to wait. They decided the second option. Let's rely on headsets on the market. That company is called InFlight VR. They're a German company, based or have their team in Barcelona. I salute them if they're hearing this podcast. We like them, but they decided to go the other route. So, which is a route that makes sense strategically, but developing our own headset enabled us to be first on the market, first to the airlines, and first with the use case. And that was something that was important to us, and it continues to be important to us to this day. So that was kind of the reason for that rationale.
Yeah, and I think also you have to think about what exists today. The VR headsets that exist today are designed so that they can be as accurate of having tracking, positional tracking accuracy in a room be as accurate as possible, so that you can run around the room, you know, do room scale or flip around and shoot guns very quickly. But perhaps that's, you know, that's all of that innovation is completely useless for you sitting in a seat in a plane. So looking at the picture of your headset, I mean, it's much smaller than anything that currently exists on the market. It looks like a pair of glasses that has a bigger visor in the front. It also doesn't look like it has that fat, you know, the fat bulge that VR headsets have. So maybe we can kind of also talk about the hardware design that you ended up kind of going with and how it all works. What display does it use? What kind of optics does it use? And how that ended up fitting your use case better than what exists today? Because yeah, hardware is not easy to make, especially when you're also having to create the entire, you know, vertical business around that, both on the software and service side.
Yeah. So let me take one step back, because I noticed there's a bunch of questions that we left unanswered because we took tangents, which is normal. But let me just come back in two sentences, which is what it is that we had to do ultimately to get this going. Speaking of the headset, of course, and we focused on that. But yes, hardware design, hardware development has been one of the bricks that we had to go to. We also had to develop, of course, the UI, which we knew, but we had to develop the CMS, which is the content management system, the software piece that encrypts, that protects the content, and that is audited by the studios. And so we had to license content from the studios as well. So we did content licensing, content management, the UI, the headset, and then we had to figure out the operations, the airline operations themselves, and the servicing of this whole thing. And that's in an essence, is what we package to the airlines and that we sell. This is really the heart of who we are. And I would kind of sum it up from a technological point of view as essentially creating a proprietary secure media platform that is around the headset, the UI, and the CMS. And that those three bricks together are glued together to create something that's very protective of the content and that works very well for passive video entertainment. And that branches back to your question. Passive video entertainment is what is the core use case for people on planes, but I would argue not just people on planes. You can look at this the following way. If you're thinking about entertainment, video entertainment, I would split the types of entertainment that we engage in along two different dimensions: active and passive, and intense versus casual. And that kind of breaks down the different entertainments in four different categories. As a whole. And active entertainment is interactive entertainment. It requires you to participate. It requires you to interact with what the thing. And that's been the core focus of VR. It's been to focus on interactive gaming in particular, which is cool because that really leverages the technology at its best. But where we actually spend most of our time individually, as well as collectively in a society, is in passive entertainment, is in sit back, relax, tell me a story entertainment. We tell bedtime stories to children, and it's kind of just, I want to sit back, kick off a series or a movie and just shut my world off and now just tell me the story, is where I think we spend a lot of our time. That's a clear use case that is underexploited, I think, and underutilizing the potential of VR and this technology as a whole. That's one split. The other split is casual versus intense, i.e., am I doing just that thing and focusing 100% of my attention on entertainment? Am I going to the opera so that I'm going to disable my phone? I'm going to not speak to my wife. I'm not going to eat. I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to look at the opera singers and be there 100% present during this 2-hour period. Or am I casually playing on Candy Crush while I'm on the train with my wife and kids? And essentially, when you're on a plane, we've gotten the understanding that, yes, people want to escape. They want to have more of the sit back and relax kind of experience above and beyond everything. I think you could give people the best game that you can possibly imagine on a 2D screen. People won't engage with it, really. I mean, you won't get past a two-digit in terms of percentage of people who use it. You'll be stuck in the low first digit. So people want to sit back and relax. And it's a place where in VR, one of the limitations is that we are de facto in the intense kind of category.
Right.
It's hard to be able to do tons of different things while you're in a hand-mounted device. I think with AR, you could argue that now AR is pushing us in a place where you could also be casual. But of course, we leveraged what technology was and said, okay, we're going to do VR, head-mounted displays, and we're going to do sit back and relax entertainment, but we're going to do it well so that people give us their time. And the best hallmark of that is what we're trying to emulate in a sense is you have the option to watch a movie on an iPad size screen, whether it's your own iPad or whether it's on the seat. What if I give you the option to go to the opera, go to a concert, or go to a movie theater? And that's really what we think the technology can do. So yeah. So anyway, that was a backstory. So to go back to your question, yes, you're right. The entire hardware industry has been focused on utilizing the cutting edge technology to emulate the world in the real world in a way that would be compelling for the heavy interactive, intense gaming experiences. But we don't need all of that. And that was, Flan's first realization when we said, we think we can do it and we can do it now. We don't need to wait because we don't need to be on the cutting edge of the technology per se. What we need to do is we need to show a large screen that's movie theater like, and we need to do that in a compelling way and a comfortable way so that people can zone out. And the technology was already there back in 2014, I think. And we really kicked off in 2015 and then 2016. But yes, you're right. And so so one of the limitations for your listeners, we did two generations of headsets. Our first generation that we called the Bravo, and then we understood that the Bravo wasn't good enough to execute on the strategy of the company, which was to focus on the premium airlines out there, what we call full service carriers, that is the opposite spectrum of the low cost carriers, your Emirates, your Qatar, your Japan Airlines, your British Airways, your Lufthansa, your Singapore Airlines, Cathay, these carriers, in their premium classes, in their premium cabins, first class, business class, in particular. So we wanted to have a top-down, it was a reason strategic approach, but have a top-down approach, top-down offering in the cabins. And therefore, what we needed to beat was not just your iPad, but now it was your TV, because because in those first classes, people had access to 20-inch, 15-inch. I mean, in the top carriers, 20-inch screens. And so that was the real thing we were going after. And the first headset that we launched on the market succeeded in generating a good experience for economy passengers. It didn't succeed in getting us in the top cabins. And we had to launch a second generation in quick succession, which is now the Alice Sky, which is now what is out, which has just been released basically in June 2018.
And what are the hardware differences between the both headsets?
Sure. So so there's basically three differences. We cut the weight of the headset. So we were already, the Bravo itself, this first generation, was already about two-thirds the weight of a Samsung Gear VR. And from that two-thirds the weight of a Samsung Gear VR, we cut off another third. So we're now at about half the weight of a Samsung Gear VR. We also cut on the design. So it now occupies about half of the volume of the Samsung Gear VR. It's much slimmer. It looks like sunglasses. Design was actually very important for our passengers. This is something that from Silicon Valley, you don't necessarily intuitively get, but we had about only a third of our passengers reportedly tell us that, yeah, how we look to the external world is important. And I'd feel a little uncomfortable. In effect, it was closer to two-thirds of the people who felt that it was very important what they looked like. So design was a key piece. We improved and then everything else in the headset improved. So we improved the resolution. We went from a sub HD, so it was an SD per eye resolution. So when I'm going to speak about resolutions, I'm not going to speak in VR language. So this is an important caveat. I'm going to speak in a movie language rather than a VR language, because what we do in
what
VR
is the difference between the languages?
Of course. What we do in VR is we take the screens and we say, well, here's the displays. And if you take these typically two displays or one display split in two, depending on how people do it, let's look at the total resolution of the display. And that's not what matters to me. I can speak at the total resolution of the displays if you want. What matters to me is if you're watching a movie in either 16:9 format or in 22:9 native movie theater format, what is the display that you perceive? There's a big difference between the two. So I'll give you the Samsung Gear VR, typically, it's a 2K VR language, 2K VR language display. But if you try to watch a movie in a Samsung Gear VR, go ahead, launch Netflix or whatever it is, whatever app you want to use, then the experience that you will get is an HD or sub HD experience on the movie itself, because you will now be showing tons of different stuff around the movie screen, whatever, Mars or nothing or whatever you want to watch, but the movie itself. And the reason why because you're stuck to the 16:9 format or you're stuck to the 22:9 format, the movie itself is in sub HD. And so anyway, first Bravo resolution from a passenger point of view, we were at 540p over 960 per eye in terms of perceived resolution. Second generation, Alice Sky, we're now in VR world resolution 4K displays, but what it really is in terms of perceived resolution is full HD per eye. So now viewers can watch content in full HD price. So that was also a major change. Yeah. And then we changed a bunch of different things, but the core pieces was design, better resolution, better comfort.
Does it have audio integrated or do you use external headphones?
So for now this was a big debate also internally as to whether we would try to design something with the audio integrated. We chose not to, not because it's not a good idea. It is. It's a great idea to have audio integrated. But to do it well in the context of a plane where active noise canceling over-ear headphones that you can properly clean from passenger to passenger and so on and so forth is very important. It was too complicated. There's hardly anything more complicated than to adapt a hardware, a headset that people wear to all the different head morphologies of people. People's IPD is different. The distance between the eyes and the nose is different. The distance between the ears is different. The height. And so adding this extra dimension of moving parts suddenly meant complicating the hardware to a level that we thought was not worth the thing. So what we did is we said, okay, scrap that for the moment. We'll get back to that though, because the generation after that is going to come back to that problem. But for the moment, let's keep these two things separate.
It's a very wise decision. Yeah. Because if you do too much, we saw it with various companies, it's just a little bit hard here and there. And I mean, looking at what you right now are basically offering is not just that you have managed to build your own hardware, but you also managed to have deals with all those major publishers like BBC, World Brothers, what do I see, 20th Century Fox.
Yep.
And in a sense, that's also something that, you know, not every startup succeeds that easily. So it's kind of, you know, content, but also a very good business integration or like business roadmap plan and also the hardware. But my question would be maybe how come that after visiting some, Silicon Valley and being at the Y Combinator, the startup became very B2B focused. I don't perceive that many I don't remember that many VR B2B companies during that time that, you know, came particularly from the Silicon Valley. So how did you manage to, not address the regular user?
We were B2B from the get-go. To be more precise, we were B2B to C from the get-go, using this intermediate business to distribute our solution over to its final users. And so that was just by factor of what it is that we chose to do, which was sell to airlines to distribute to passengers. And here's why it was, from a strategic point of view, it was an interesting one. It's because you don't necessarily realize the numbers that are associated with the airline market, but the top 20 carriers, top 20 airlines in the airline industry carry 500 million passengers around the world every year,
Market.
Every single year. Actually, unique pass. It's huge.
Whoa.
You sign Air France, that's 60 million passengers a year. That's the size of France that flies with this company. Go with a United or Delta, multiply these numbers by another two. So the signing this one single contract, if you could, not an easy thing to do, but being able, or at least in principle, convincing one of these major airlines to switch to you is a distribution access to an extraordinary number of users. And that is very interesting for us. It's a way to accelerate the adoption by order of magnitude than if we were trying to go at it purely consumer.
Absolutely.
So we were B2B from the get-go. Silicon Valley, or more precisely, Y Combinator didn't discourage us from being B2B. There's a tons of very good B2B Y Combinator companies out there. And so we were just one of them. So that was not the question. There was an advantage also. It was the second key advantage of being a B2B2C company in the VR space. Is that we were largely void of, well, not true, but the level of pressure around cost was way less intense in this B2B2C space than it is in the B2C space. Because
by which factor? So what kind of factor could you factor in?
Yeah. We spoke about the hardware, so let's focus on the hardware again. In the hardware space, you want to sell to consumers, what is the ultimate price to the consumer is a key question. and all of the components in VR following Moore's law, that's true of the displays, that's true of the optical systems themselves, that's true of the processors that we're using. So everything is decreasing rapidly in terms of cost. But if you're one of the first people trying to create this market, you're stuck where you first have to release something that has to be relatively expensive, or you're trying to figure out what are the trade-offs that you're going to do, or else you're going to launch a HoloLens, which can't possibly be a real consumer device if you're going to sell it for more than $1,000. Now, in our case, because we're selling to airlines, our benchmark is not somebody's iPad. I'm not trying to convince somebody to buy a headset versus buy an iPad. I'm trying to convince an airline to buy our service versus, going from a 17-inch to a 19-inch screen, or whatever that is. It so happens that in the airline industry, everything costs an arm and a leg. You think of anything on a plane and add a zero, and you're about accurate as to what it costs. Add one or two zeros. I was at a conference in New York a couple weeks ago. I asked the audience, how much do you think these screens cost? And I remember my neighbor told me, I don't know, maybe $100, $80, something of the order of magnitude. There was two order of magnitudes off.
Wow. Right?
It costs someplace between, depending on what we're talking about, if you take basically all the IT system, divide that by the number of seats, you're talking $10,000 to $20,000, depending on the plane. Person.
And typically, Whoa. These screens are not the best, or don't have the best quality, or even the best viewing angles, which you can imagine is so important when the seat in front of you reclines and you have to squat down to look at the screen correctly.
No, but they suck. that's really what it is, and they suck because they're installed for 7 to 10 years. They're calculate what that means. That means the screen that's in front of you on average is between three and a half and 5 years old. And and so of course your tablet is going to beat that. There's no question about that. So anyway, because these system costs are super expensive, suddenly we had a lot of room to play with. And so we could basically design a headset with relatively expensive components if we wanted to, and still have room to properly sell to airlines while providing the superior kind of experience to the ultimate passengers. And that was the strategic route that we went through. It doesn't mean we won't ever do consumer. It's always been in the back of our heads because our vision has always exceeded the in-flight entertainment space. But that's in broader discussion.
Well, you're not missing out on not being in the consumer space currently. I mean, just with where we are. I mean, we talk a lot about consumer technology here because primarily because there are articles out there that are just so bad at interpreting the data and want to just write, VR is dead articles, but don't understand that the growth that we're seeing right now is actually indicates really healthy growth and has a clear, and despite, some sort of a niche market ahead, but that is definitely in a growing state. But for planes, you would never want to sell directly to consumers. Obviously, you have to go through the planes.
Not for planes. The key question is, can we make use of a very cinematic focused experience to consumers for them to be able to have on the go wherever they are, not just on a plane as given by the airline? We think the answer is ultimately yes. At that time, it's just a question of are the conditions there in terms of content offering, headset, and so on and so forth that we can make that all of this makes sense. Others have tried before us. Others have failed. We'll see.
I have two questions that I want to kind of go into. One is the comfort and some of the corrections that you guys offer. So you mentioned IPD, and I'm seeing on your website that you also have like dioptric correction, which I think very few headsets do. And second is going to be content, but let's kind of start with the comfort aspect. Your headset, or at least the second one, this new generation Allo Sky doesn't have a strap around it. This is kind of slips on your ears like a pair of glasses do. And that I think can accommodate a lot for people that have hair and headsets with, a top strap and a full strap around your head typically just make a clumsy experience of actually putting it on. I'm seeing a side view angle. At least that's how I'm interpreting it as a pair of slip on glasses. But, how in terms of, optics correction, like people have such different eyes, you need to have displays or optics that move, to adjust for IPD, or people that wear glasses typically with VR headsets either have to force their glasses in or just don't wear it. How did you kind of tackle these huge questions, especially when you're going to be servicing all sorts of passengers, right? Not VR developers.
Yeah. So, well, first let me correct it. The Owl Sky does have a band. So it's a one single band that goes behind the head. We went the band that goes above, and we decided not to do the glasses thing, just the temples. The reason why that is the case is if you use temples, then the entire weight is on your nose. And one of the painful discoveries that I think everyone in the headset space has made is that the nose will not support any kind of weight without being uncomfortable very quickly. Even your own reading glasses, even the weight of that is ultimately going to strain your nose. So, but that's kind of the limit of what you can do with regular glasses. But yes, I mean, you're describing what is a design challenge, which is how do you fit these glasses in the myriad of different setups or passenger setups to people who have glasses, who wear reading glasses, who have different kind of eye problems and so on and so forth. The first generation was super simple. That was a fantastic thing of the Bravo. It was big, it was bulky, it was ugly, but it enabled people to wear their glasses underneath the headset itself. And so we would solve all of these problems at the same time. The optics were huge, meaning not Gear VR huge, but still were big enough that we didn't have any IPD adjustments. So all of that, it was just wear and play, and that worked beautifully for our use case. When we decided to change technologies, and we did, we went from a single OLED screen to switching to two micro OLED screens. And we did so because that was what enabled us to reduce the design drastically, as well as to improve the resolution drastically, multiplying it by four from one generation to the other. When we did that, that meant suddenly that we had to, the optical system needs to be much more precise in where the iris of our users were. And so now we needed IPD adjustments. And the question was, well, what do we do with those that wear glasses? And there was this whole internal debate. And we looked at all the data. Can we do without their optic adjustments and without IPD adjustments? And the ultimate answer was no on neither case. And I think we don't, you know, we're a global company from day one. We're selling to airlines. Airlines have people from all over the world, especially the big airlines, flying with them. If you take the whole Asian market, there's about half of Asians that are nearsighted. It's a big optical difficulty with the entire Asian continent. The compelling reason why we decided to bring in the optic adjustment was to be able to cater to the Cathay, the Singapore, and behind them, the Emirates, Qatar, and Etihad, who half of their passengers are Asians, as they carry passengers from Asia to Europe, mostly. That was a key part of the decision. And so we did it, and then once you make that decision, how do you make it simple and easy? So the whole UI and the simplicity of use is a fundamental part of the hardware design, hardware and software, but especially the hardware design. And so we have, you know, on the headset, we have two dioptric adjustments that are basically adjusted like you would binoculars. Hoping that people kind of figure that out, and they kind of do. And one button to allow for IPD adjustment and block the IPDs for each user. We were able to forego any nose pieces, which some other headset manufacturers have had. Went that route. We don't need that. Their nose is hardly in contact with the headset itself. And we do this setup with the user where for the first couple minutes, what he's actually doing is doing optical setups, setting up the left eye, setting up the right eye, and making sure that the IPD is right. And once we're there, we recompense the user after he spends 2 minutes with his voice kind of guiding voice plus visuals guiding him through this optical setup. We recompense him with a with a cool, you know, wow, in your face kind of video to say, okay, well, this part is over now. Now enjoy. And so that's what we do. But it's a design challenge, and the whole headset piece of it's mostly a design challenge, more so than it is a technological challenge.
And where does the calculation happen? So is it some kind of tether device, or you have it in built in, or is there basically a phone tethering mode? Or
no, it's all in one. So it's all on the device itself.
So it's just a headset, 250 grams.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow. What's the battery life?
We have about three and a half hours of battery life. And to extend that, you plug it into a simple USB socket, and that's extended to infinity.
That's pretty impressive. I saw on your website that you're searching for Python developers, so I assume that your 3D UI runs on some kind of Python magic?
Yeah, so I'm a business founder, so I'm not the right person to go into the technicals. Mm-hmm. But in a nutshell, yes, the UI itself is reliant on Android. We have our own Android build. And then the CMS, the entire back-end side of things on managing the content and managing different fleets of devices that are flying for different airlines that have different rights with all protected content that's flowing through the system in a way that is secure enough for the studios to approve, that is all mostly Python language. And
okay. And how does the syncing happens between the different flights? So let's say I take the headset out of one plane, I put it in another. Do you rely on in-flight Wi-Fi in flight cellular connection, or it happens on the ground?
No, so the entire device is completely independent, doesn't require any kind of connectivity. So you could be in space and on the space station and still use it just as is for about 3.5 hours, and then you need to plug it into USB. It does have, obviously, Bluetooth and wireless connectivity. The Bluetooth is mostly there for Bluetooth headphones connectivity. We are using the Bluetooth for some communication between the devices and the cabin crew tablets, so they can basically are ways to communicate between the crew and the passengers. One-way communication, obviously, descending communication. And we are using also the Wi-Fi connectivity to be able to plug into wireless infrastructure that exists, if it exists. Mostly, however, on long-haul flights, and for premium, the full-service carriers, so we are speaking about the bigger planes here, mostly that is absent of these planes. So we're not relying on that at all. So all the content is stored directly on the device. The syncing happens. So how do we update the content and so on and so forth, bring it on? We have right now we have 128 gigs on the device, and we're moving to 256 gigs. That gives us room for between, 30 movies plus extras, the 360 videos and so on and so forth, which are shorter in duration, to about 60 as we double the size of the storage, and then when we on the planes where we do have access to bring your own device wireless connectivity to be able to stream movies, we can. The problem with that is the movies are rarely in good enough quality. A resolution, and they're not fresh. And it's not just a technological problem, or a bandwidth problem. It's actually a limitation from the studios, because the Hollywood studios consider that streaming movies through wireless networks on devices that are not necessarily purely airline controlled, which is typically how these systems are built, so that you can watch them on your phone, on your tablet, or whatever, is a security problem, and so they only allow lower resolution and late in terms of not fresh content to be able to be streamed that way, because they don't want the very latest blockbuster to be released then pirated through that system. So the advantage of being local is we have access to full HD fresh content, which is fundamental for the offer.
And not only that, but, you know, these companies, especially for the blockbuster movies, they spend a lot of time on the post conversion to stereo 3D. And now with, you know, 3D TVs kind of being dead, there's almost no real consumer market for after those cinematic releases. So I can see them, you know, taking advantage of in-flight entertainment as a place to actually put those 3D movies.
Yep. And I think as all of us who've watched 3D movies on VR headsets in general, just stereoscopic 3D is when you have a one display per eye kind of setup, is so much more compelling than the polarized, images and so on and so forth. I mean, to me, it's really giving a second life to 3D. 3D as it should be experienced.
Absolutely.
So it's cool.
Even with VR headsets today, people host, you know, movie nights in big screen VR to watch stereo 3D movies together. And because you're already wearing something in your head, you know, it's a free bonus that you get by already being convinced to be in VR that, like 3D movies work really well. David, so to wrap things up, how can people perhaps book a flight or be on a flight that they could experience, a VR headset in their flight seat? Because I believe, have you guys launched yet on airlines today? Or is there a flight you can book?
Yeah, sure. So we launched the first generation based service launched back in 2017, January 2017, and we have several airline clients that are proposing this to their passengers. That's XL Airways, Corsair. We're on trains also, incidentally. We were on cruise ships. We haven't spoken about that. We're on different sorts, but these are smaller. These are carriers that you probably don't know because they're smaller in size than the big guys. And that was one of the purpose why we launched the second generation. Second generation just launched this summer. And it took flights on board an Air France subsidiary, and now it took flight on Alaska Airlines. It's took flight, I'm on a public podcast, so I'm on three other carriers that you would know, but who haven't yet made the announcement, and all of this for full-blown deployments in 2019. So all of these announcements are going to come in. It's just that I can't shoot the gun here. But including in the U.S., you will be able to get an experience of the second gen.
Great. And how can people find out more about you, David, and more about Skylights? They want to follow your progress.
About me.
Or contact you.
Not easy because I'm not. I'm an asocial person when it comes to social media, personally, but obviously shoot me an email. It's david@skylights.aero, AERO at the end. And I'll be happy to respond. And, about the company, same thing, go to our website, skylights.aero. We, this time, have a communication marketing team who are better than I am. So, we're on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Twitter, whatever it is, follow us on all of these things and keep you updated. Including on some important moves that we are going to announce soon not just the in-flight side, and B, not just the B2B side.
Oh,
great.
So you're going to hear more about you soon.
Yes, and thank you all for listening. You can find the Research VR podcast on Twitter at ResearchVRcast. You can find us on Patreon as well. Again, consider supporting the podcast, keeping the virtual lights in this virtual room on, except we're not recording this in VR today, fortunately. But yes, please consider supporting us. I'm actually going to be making some big changes to Patreon soon enough, and it's going to be tied in with Everyday Scan, the VR photogrammetry work that I've been doing a lot more. So there's going to be some fun announcements coming on there.
So a lot of vertical integration.
There will be lots of integration. There'll be more value, more bang for the buck coming soon ahead. Thank you again, David, for joining us. This has been a really fun and informative conversation.
Thank you, Az. Thank you, Peter. It was lovely.
Fantastic. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. And goodbye. And thank you again to Haptix for sponsoring this episode. You can find them at partners@haptix.com. Contact them at partners@haptix.com if you're a developer and you are interested in pursuing haptic feedback. See you guys next week.